Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Heads, Scars and Carry-Ons, a podcast about black girls living abroad. I'm Mommy B, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Abby AK. Hi Mommy, hi everybody.
Hi everyone.
Hello.
Oh my god, we're back.
We're back. 2021, woohoo! 2021.
Yeah, it sounds like a futuristic date that we shouldn't be living through, but we made it through 2020, so anything is possible.
And you know what? That's a good thing to really acknowledge. Like, I think for everybody, in some way or another, just the world, across the world, one shared thing, 2020 was probably hard for some people, and I really hope there were good moments and good blessings, but for many there were elements that were hard. So to say we made it through is not even a joke. Because people weren't making it through. So very thankful to enter 2021. It's still a challenge, but we move forward. We progress, we move.
Yeah,
we move.
That's what we do. And we thought we would return to your ears and give you something exciting, we say. Hopefully not burying the lead.
You need to listen.
What else are you doing? You're not getting anywhere. So here we are to talk about travel, even though we can't travel. As we have always done. And I'm in London right now. And Abby, where are you?
Amsterdam. Oh my gosh. This is very off topic, but it snowed today. And I literally screamed, I don't like the snow, but it looks so good. And it snowed today. And I was like, oh, it's so nice.
Yeah. Snow is best when you're inside and warm.
Exactly. Good. I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. We have a very, very special episode for you guys, considering we thought we would just come back with a splash. And a pizzazz. As you can see, it's been a long time since I've recorded. So words just have lost from me. Yeah. What are we doing today, Abs? Tell the people.
So today we actually have an interview, and we have the privilege of interview world-renowned writer Georgina Lawton, who is debuting her first book called Raceless. Raceless in Search of Family, Identity, and the Truth About Where You Belong. So a stunning family memoir by journalist Georgina Lawton, exploring race, identity, and the effect of long-held secrets on a happy family. In Georgina Lawton's childhood home, her blackness was never acknowledged. The obvious fact of her brown skin, ignored by her white parents. Over time, secrets and a complex family story became accepted as truth, and Georgina found herself complicit in the erasure of her racial identity.
Woo, that sounds like a good read.
Yeah, it was.
It's a real story. Exactly, yeah. And it was a really good read. And a bit about Georgina, for those of you that don't know Georgina Lawton, if you've never come across her work, you may have probably actually come across her work and not realised it, but she is a 20-something author and host, a former Guardian Weekend columnist. She also writes for a number of other publications, such as The Independent, Stylist, Galden, Travel Plus Leisure, Vice, Time Out London, and more. She also has her own podcast on Audible on the DNA testing industry called The Secrets in Us. And I think it came out in November of last year, November 2020. Yeah, she's doing all the things, and she's an avid traveler, hence why we have interviewed her on today's episode. Yeah, she's like a big, big fan of traveling, living abroad, lives abroad. When we interviewed her, she was
She packed up and went to Lisbon. So she's living abroad, and a lot of her journey, and we will discuss it with her. You'll hear more in terms of exploring her identity, was discovered when she was actually abroad in many different places and traveling. And there's a lot that Georgina goes into detail about, even stuff that we face with, you know, our blackness, like the hair industry and traveling, to understand more about that. So there's a whole heap of travel in this book, but also, you know, we love to read. We're a bit of, you know, we love a good book, and I love a good secret. I love a gist. So this was perfect. Yeah. I was like,
and it's real life.
It's real life gist. Yeah.
Shall we go to the interview?
Yeah, let's get to it. Let's welcome Georgina Lawton.
Enjoy.
My foray into the world of weave was birthed in Peckham. I wandered into black hair salons in Rye Lane and found nimble-fingered Nigerian women chewing gum indolently. They installed a straw-like, corn-coloured, Beyoncé circa baby boy, 24-inch number, every 3 months. I remember going to school the next day to present something in front of the whole class and feeling that my lustrous new head of hair felt alien on my scalp. But I would keep that look for another 4 years, and gradually I began to look forward to the transformative process that came from sourcing Rapunzel-esque locks of hair in pockets of South London. And of course, to the final look, which I viewed as far more chic than my natural head of curls. A weave had a transformative, uplifting effect. I felt more attractive, more sophisticated, and I wrongly believed that I blended in more among family and friends. In Vietnam, I'd met owners and brothers, Win and Phan, whose client-facing names were Jack and Tom, LOL, for a tour of their factory and village where they source their hair. After a quick exchange of pleasantries in their sorting office in Hanoi, I'd climbed into the back of their car for a journey of almost 2 hours. When I woke up, it was in front of a large house made of concrete blocks off a busy main road. I had no idea where I was, but was told the house belonged to their aunt too. As I followed the brothers into the house, which was adorned with bright family photos and red calendars, I realised I had stepped into the very humble beginnings of the very lucrative world of hair trading. Our aunt, she finds the girls and arranges the cutting of hair, and we come and collect the hair every few weeks, Wynne, a slight man with glasses, told me as I sat down on a faded floral sofa opposite several women who were sorting and weighing hair while positioned on tiny blue plastic chairs that were extremely close to the floor. I was quickly given a hot cup of lemon tea to sip by Aunt Two, which was tasty but almost cloying in its sweetness. I was told Two employed many others, who drive through remote villages in the mountains, advertising their services by shouting prices through megaphones. They set up impromptu haircuts beside the trucks, and then the hair is transported back to Two, who sells it to her nephews for an agreed price. It's a full-scale operation in which the young women selling their hair rarely receive fair remuneration. But I'm told for locks between 28 and 32 inches long, the brothers pay a generous $75. And they say hair between 16 to 27 inches can sell for $50 to $60. In a country where the average monthly wage is less than $200, these prices sound pretty unbelievable. And later online, I discover that $5 per ponytail is actually a lot closer to the average price. The global hair trading market is notorious for its lack of regulation and often exploits women from farming backgrounds and those who live in abject poverty. But with only the brothers who run their business to translate and provide prices, that day in their aunt's house, I smiled and took photos on my camera, thinking back to all the packets of hair I had once purchased, how they end up smooth, silky, and severely marked up in price once they leave this house in Hanoi. On the shelves of hair shops from Tottenham to Tooting, one 14-inch, 3.5 pack of Remy hair can sell for around £65. The price increasing incrementally if the hair is virgin. But these words are often no more than clever marketing jargon employed by manufacturers to seduce buyers into thinking they're purchasing a high-quality product. The US, China, and the UK are the top three global importers of hair respectively, but each country has a hair market devoid of any regulation. I was duped many times as a teenager, buying hair online that was labelled as pure and unprocessed, only to attempt to dye it at home and find the natural black shade didn't budge an inch. So yeah, that's a little taster, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, having read it, I was like, oh, you need to stop. You need, like, it is a wild industry indeed, yeah, to go through. But thank you for reading through, like giving us a chapter and a taste of the book as well. So you use a lot of research in your book, and I think that's been the good thing about it. As much as you have a story to tell and it's very personal to you, there's so much research just about Black British history, some critical race theory. So if we cover into the research, we'll come back to the hair though, yeah, later, because I like to touch on
books. We have a whole episode on hair.
Have a whole episode, yeah.
Of course, yeah, I can imagine.
But you grew up in a trans, or someone who grew up in a transracial family. Yes. I know you didn't really know, but what does it mean? What does transracial mean for you personally? Like, let's even just uncover what transracial means. And then also for you as in a personal perspective.
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked this question, because I feel like the word has been hijacked in the past couple of years. And before it became controversial and before it was hijacked by this woman that I do not want to name. And
we're not naming her.
Before that word was associated with her, it was actually a word like thrown around in adoption circles. Like, it's been used since the 1970s and it's used to denote the experience of people who are raised by people who aren't of the same race to them. So it's relating to children of colour, black and brown kids who are raised by white caregivers. And transracial experience is just being caught in between two cultures, caught in between two ethnicities. It doesn't mean somebody who wakes up and decides to change their race. That's not what it means. But obviously in the past few years, it's been taken to mean that. But for me, growing up in a white home and being raised by an Irish mum and a white dad, I guess years later, I realised that I had a transracial experience. But of course, at the time, it was just, you know, my family. I didn't know them. I didn't look like them. It wasn't spoken about. But that was the definition of a transracial upbringing. Just, you know, being raised by people who are of a different cultural background to you and a different racial background. So that's what it means to me. And I hope, it begins to get reappropriated by the right people. It's really important. And it's a real experience for people who have been adopted and people who've, I've been raised by people that just don't look like them. It's an actual thing.
Yeah, because you also go into a lot about farming, which has a similar experience. And it was quite funny because myself and Mame had a very intense and deep conversation around farming in this area. And it's a real thing because, you know, I knew of it, but we didn't know that it had, I didn't know it had a word. And I know Derek Owusu talks about it. And
that reminds me. But I think I think with terms like that, like it contains multitudes, but at least having something that you can call it kind of, I think, gives it a bit of an identity almost, rather than like, you know, it's not this mouthful of, well, I was raised by this person and this person and this happened. And it actually becomes something that is experienced by another group of people that have had that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I wanted to, obviously, you know, I started out writing this and I knew it was going to be a memoir, but I also knew that I wanted to broaden it out and include and refer to other people who have had similar experiences and draw parallels. Because I wasn't farmed, and I say in the book in that way. And I don't know what it's like to be, I guess, you know, having to deal with two sets of families and the loss of home. I don't know what that feels like in a way, because I've had the one home and one set of parents, but I've not, I guess, what I have battled with is the secrets and the sort of shame that comes around my identity. So there's parallels that can be drawn between me and people who were farmed and fostered, and I've tried to do that, and I've tried to include some experiences and broaden it out and talk about some research as well as my own story, because I know it makes it stronger and it adds to that discourse, and it makes me sound, I guess, a little less mad when I realize that there's other people that have been raised in similar ways with the secrets and the same at the heart. Which is something I realised.
It is that secret bit area, because you do go into, like, you were and you are loved and you had a loving family, but it's this, when you add the secrets on top, I'm just like, I can't.
And I think it's one of those things that just makes you like, it's like a double take thing. It's kind of like you're having to, at least that's how it read and that's kind of how it feels, like you're having to rewrite a history that you thought you knew. That is, you know, that'll mess you up, you know, in that way. And actually, on, I guess, off the back of that, like, we're talking about your family and, like, exactly, you were really loved. I mean, I feel like you did, like, a really, really amazing job of, like, empathizing with your mother and the decisions that she made, and acknowledging also that you got love and support from your parents growing up. But I guess, like, one of the questions that came to mind when I was reading your book was, like, what was it like actually writing that, like, in a way that acknowledged these very, to some could say, opposing things of, like, I have this really loving family and I have this really loving parent, but they also kept this very big thing for me that had all these other ramifications. Like, how did you, what was it like to actually put that down on paper and, like, process that, I suppose?
You want us to go into a bit more about Zeke, because I don't know if people listen.
Yes,
to So, it was really difficult to, I guess, do a lot at once when I was writing this book, because I was going to therapy with my mum at the time, and we were talking about why she was unable to talk about my race growing up. And I write in my book that when my dad passed away in 2015, that was the catalyst for me wanting to find out more about who I was related to, because when he got sick, he had cancer. I knew that once he passed away, sort of the truth would pass away with him. So I tried to go into it a little bit more when he was alive, but he was so sick, it didn't seem like the right time to like really prep for answers. So after he passed away, I'd already kind of gathered his permission to take a DNA sample. And when he passed away, I kept it on the shelf for like a whole year. And then a year after he passed away, I decided to get it processed, and it revealed, right, my dad isn't my biological dad. And then, like you said, I had to go through the process of sort of rewriting my history, but also sort of grieving again, because I lost him once as a father physically. And then I'd lost that tie that I thought I had between us, which was biological. And it was really, there's no sort of words to describe how you deal with that level of shock in your life sort of all at once. And then that's why I went traveling, to sort of find myself, but also to put some distance between me and my mum, because she really got the brunt of my rage and my anger.
Yeah.
You know, she was the one that knew the truth all along, but her and my dad, they'd made a joint decision not to speak about it. But the fact that he wasn't here meant that all my anger got directed at her, basically. So it was really, really tough in the process of writing about this stuff online. I started writing about it in The Guardian, and then that led to this book. And it was really tough to put it all down on paper whilst we were going to therapy. So when I got back from traveling, we started going to therapy together, and I had so much anger. Like, I was furious, and I'd gone away to travel, and it had given me a lot, and it had given me space, and it had given me sort of the ability to sort of, I guess,
process.
Yeah. Mm. Design myself as the woman that I wanted to be. Cause there's all this stuff that I didn't do growing up, cause I was scared to be associated with other black communities and other black people, because I wanted to be part of my family, and everyone kept saying, oh, you're black, or you're mixed, or you look Eritrean, or you look Ethiopian, or you look this or that. And I never knew my place, but I knew that I wanted to stay with my family as a kid, because that's, you know, that's natural and it's instinctual. You want to stay with the people that love you. But because of that, there was loads that I hadn't done, like even really basic stuff like getting my hair braided. Like, I hadn't done that because I was scared that it would mark me out as more of an outsider in my life, in my family, and in my group of people that I hung around with. So all that stuff I did when I was traveling, and then when I came back, trying to explain all this to my mum, trying to explain all the stuff that I'd missed out on, whilst you know, still keeping our relationship intact, because she's my mum and I love her. I'd never sort of stop talking to her, but there was a period where I almost did, because she couldn't understand at first how difficult all this had been. So
it seemed from reading the book in the early stages, she wasn't really into acknowledging everything. And I can imagine it wasn't easy for her, but obviously you were going through it after you found out about the DNA test, and you called her and you said, look, I'm half Nigerian. And so I can imagine that was a process. And even when you talk about braiding your hair, I know you mentioned to your friend, like, tasting Nigerian food and having that experience, you had to find that. So it's really interesting to just hear, like, you had to try and relive that. But I'm glad that you were able to do it and be like, now, like, I'm not, I can live into it a lot more and kind of just get the healing. So, how has it impacted, especially writing this book, your family relationship since?
They've got a lot stronger as a result.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. My mum and I took 2 years of therapy, and I was going every week to a little room in Balham talking with my mum about our life and what she missed out on, and trying to understand her decisions for not coming out with the truth earlier and trying to get her to understand the impact that all that had on me, and also both of us trying to grieve for our dad. It was really, we were trying to come together and also trying to be there for each other whilst trying to understand each other's reasoning. So it was a lot, but now I'm happy to say that she's so much more open as a person. I feel like I know her so much more, and I can see her as a person who's made choices and who made difficult decisions, not just, you know, as a mum. I can see her fully with all her faults and with all her great points as well. So it's been a lot. And, you know, even sitting in therapy talking with your mum about sex and who my biological father is, and if she can remember this affair, this one night stand abuse me, it was very bizarre talking with your mum about that level of detail about how you were conceived. And
that's such show of commitment also, though, for, you know, to do that for 2 years. You know, there's something about, actually, we really, really want to work through this.
We did, both of us. And I think yeah, I wasn't sure at first if we would be able to come through it, because it was just so incredibly like soul wrenching to go there every week and talk to your mum in this level of detail about your innermost desires and hurts and fears. But we didn't want to lose each other, and I think my dad had left such a great legacy that we had that strength, that initial kind of foundation as a family. So I never really considered, you know, cutting my mum out and not talking to her, because our relationship had never been based on that much sort of animosity. There was definitely a distance there because of this lie, but it wasn't an anger or a rage. We just had to sort of come together, and with somebody's help, the professional's help, we managed to do that. So I think our relationship is a lot stronger. And in the podcast on Audible called The Secrets in Us, she's interviewed, like I get to interview her and I talk to her. And
I'm gonna check in on that one.
You can hear her, talking. I never thought she'd be able to do that like years ago.
Yeah, that's
amazing. But that's powerful, right? Because I think what Mame said, the commitment you both put in, just acknowledging even therapy and the help. Sometimes you need to get help and talk it through. And 2 years, it's not easy, you know, to go through. But even that she's able, and it's brought you stronger together. I love that. I really do. Because I found it hard in the beginning to empathize. I was just like, I had feelings. I was like, it's not even my life. So, and then I started empathizing. I was like, you don't know. So
interesting. Yeah, people sort of fall into one of two camps when I talk to them. Yes. It's either, I get a lot of people from sort of an older generation saying, I thought you were very hard on your mom. And, you know, I'll get emails and saying all kinds of stuff like that. And then people are age are a little bit more critical and a little bit more like, how could she raise a colorblind child if the child is black? Like, how? Like, people are very, it's a lot. So I'm glad sometimes my mum's not on the internet, because when I used to write about family in the Guardian, sometimes the comments would be so critical of my mum and I'd feel bad and I'd try to sort of not write from a place of rage.
Yeah, and I don't think you did.
No,
you wrote from such a place like of that. Love.
I'm glad that came across, because if I'd written this book 4 years ago, I would have been fuming and it would have been a different book. So I'm glad, I'm glad I took the time out to sort of reflect, because I was I've gone through all the different stages of loss, like as you do. And if I wrote it a few years ago, I think it would have been a very different book. So I'm glad that you think it's coming out of love, because that's what I'm trying to
do. And like, I think the levity definitely comes in with the travel aspects of the book, of which there are many. We obviously enjoyed that a lot, the travel podcast. But like, you go to so many different places and you talk about kind of discovering, almost kind of go through these different kinds of blackness, depending on where you are. You know, you have experiences or you interact with people that way. And I think like some of the places I've mentioned, like New York, Cuba, Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, like, it was so, I felt like I was there, not in my house.
Yes. And you know, it's good escapism. I was like,
it was
good escapism.
Just for that. But I suppose one of my questions was, which place did you feel was like, if there was one place that you felt like was a turning point in your quest to feel more like grounded in an identity?
More grounded. I guess every place brought something different for me. Like, I didn't actually put it in the book, but I went to Brazil last year, so the book had already sort of been done. It was
okay.
I went to Brazil. We're in 2021 now. I went to Brazil in the middle of
I was about to say, you were traveling last year?
We're in 2021, aren't we? I went to Brazil in February 2019, and that was incredible, because even though, you know, there's so much of a racial hierarchy in Brazil, and it's really obvious, but when you speak to the people day to day who look like you, they're so open, they're so amazing, they're so incredibly friendly. And I went during Carnival, and I met these amazing women, and, you know, they took me around, they were helping me order drinks, and like, they just adopted me for the Carnival. And I was just thinking, if we were in London, there's no way I'd let a random girl follow me around a love box or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would just, we're so That's not. True.
We're not nice. Let's be real. We're not nice. We're like, we're not
nice. Yeah. Maybe it's another thing, but like, just traveling and meeting women across the diaspora and seeing these similarities and seeing how people interact with one another that's very different to being black in London, very different. I would say Brazil definitely gave me a lot and made me feel quite I don't want to say at home, because I always felt like a tourist because of the language barrier. And again, yeah. There's a lot of racism in Brazil, and you can see that from the way in which people, you know, darker skin colours are living in favelas, they're doing the worst jobs. But just in carnival, meeting other women was amazing, and it was incredibly enriching. And I remember thinking, like, God, they're just so open and friendly. And it was great to see that vibrancy and that that richness across the African diaspora that I just never imagined in Brazil. I couldn't imagine it would be that sort of open and amazing. So I think Brazil... And also in the book, I write about going to Dominican Republic and having all these weird experiences with my hair, because they're very having straight hair, but they were amazingly fun people to be around as well. So I guess that taught me a lot about myself, and that taught me a lot about the impact of, I guess, colonialism on beauty standards across the diaspora, and seeing that obsession with hair.
Yeah, we have so much.
It was really interesting. And I think, even though that was a bit of a shock for me, I still learned a lot about myself in the Dominican Republic, and I love that country. It was gorgeous.
I really liked your account of like the Dominican Republic, especially because it was like it just subverted exactly like you said, being black and being a black woman in London, where you go to Peckham, you go where to go get your hair, like you can have all different this, that, and the other. No one's really gonna be saying anything because it's just expected. So it did shock me to hear that it was very like anti-natural hair, the hair that grows directly out of your head.
It's not the case.
It's bad, you know? And so hearing that experience was just really, that was really interesting to me, definitely. Like, I didn't know that about the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, I'm sure when, you know, this book comes out in the States, I might get schooled by a lot of, like, negatively, but that wasn't my intention at all. It was incredible. No. You know, rich experience, but they deal with race differently there. They've got a lot of different ethnic groups, and they really, really focus on sort of looking black with European ancestry.
That's the
thing that they really focus on.
There's a lot of colorism.
Colorism. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. In terms of what they perceive to be the most beautiful, and I think that comes out in how they handle hair. But I think things have got a lot better. They've got a really strong curly hair movement going on.
Which you talk about. Yeah, which was very, like, I don't feel like it was like a negative, like, oh, don't go there. It didn't feel like that. It just felt like
educational.
Very educational, exactly. It was like, oh, this is a thing that's happening here, but also there's this other stuff going on.
Yeah. And you can see across the diaspora what links us as black people and what links us as women, and this kind of, you know, process of beautifying ourselves that looks different in every country, and what is beautiful is different in every country. But what I noticed when I traveled was the impact of colonial forces across African cultures. It's real, and it's incredibly pervasive. And we've got our own issues in the UK, but in the Dominican Republic, I was shocked to see the obsession with straight hair. It was a lot.
Yeah. And when you talk about it, sometimes people feel like it's not real, but it really, colonialism has had such a big impact. And that can be a whole nother episode. Let me write that down. as well. And so, Georgina, I was salty. I've already said this to you. This feeds into the next question, still rolling, because you are currently in Portugal.
Yes.
And I know it's cold, as you said, but actually we're all in different parts, because I'm countries. I'm Amsterdam at the moment. Cool. Yes. Nice. So yeah, and Mane
is
in London. But yeah, so I'm assuming as well, and we can go into this. Why do you think living abroad, you know, had such a big impact on you? Are you living abroad now? Like, give us more insight.
So I'm in Portugal for the time being, just lockdown living with housemates wasn't the one. And
okay.
Yeah. Well, that could be a whole episode. No,
we'll bring you back. Don't worry.
I've gone through all the phases. Like, I was at home with my mum for lockdown one, and that was lovely because that sort of brought us back together and showed me that I can be at home for an extended period of time, and we can live together, and, you know, not all our interactions are focused on the past or on grief or on race. We're just mother and daughter, so that was really nice to see that in lockdown one, and then lockdown two, I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to my house chair, try and get some work done. But I just wasn't feeling it. So I decided to move to Portugal.
Yes.
At the end of 2020. And yeah, I've been here like 3 months now. And I got my residency. So that's
yes. Cool. You know, I got my residency today, people. Sorry, just to jump in. So yeah, we're residency twins.
Amazing. Yeah, it feels good, doesn't it? You're like, wow.
Yeah.
I love this. I like that we're all, look, we all lived in London and every single one of us has residency elsewhere. Yeah, in Australia.
Oh wow! Okay, you've been
We're like, yeah, Europe. Australia.
That's as far away as possible.
And yeah, Portugal's really nice. It's just got really cold here, so it's unfortunately apparently the coldest winter they've had in like 30 years. And these houses do not have central heating, so I was really rethinking my life choices.
True. Yeah, that's a big thing. True. Yeah, why would they need it?
It's been a bit much, but but then I was on the beach in November, so I can't really complain.
Wow. On that note. Yeah. So on this show, we talk a lot about experiencing our blackness, you know, when we're living abroad and what that's like and how sometimes it brings you closer to it when you're outside of your home, because you tend to grasp onto your identity outside of your comfort zone. At least that's what I found. That's what kind of Abby and I have talked about before. Yeah. But it seemed like from your book, for you, almost in some ways, the opposite happened. Like you had to move away from home, what you knew was home, to discover what your identity was. Do you feel like that's a fair assumption, or do you feel like I'm simplifying it too much?
I guess, you know, being racialized as black whilst I was growing up, I always knew I had to accept that on some level, but I didn't have the tools as a child to really understand how to do that. I didn't really know much about DNA testing when I was like 13, 14. So I always knew deep down that the story that my parents told me that I was related to them, it didn't make sense. But I guess I had to step outside my community and the white spaces that I grew up in. I grew up in Sutton, which is, you know, zone 5 London, very white back in the early 2000s. It's got a lot more mixed now, but it's sort of near Croydon and near
Mitcham
and Wimbledon in between that area. Yeah. So on the outskirts of London, very homogenous, very white. And I had to leave in order to find another part of me that I couldn't access there. I had to go and explore the parts of me that I'd been scared to access. And I had to be around other black people, basically. I had to... Yeah. I had to live in spaces where I could see myself reflected back to me, and that was really important. So I don't know if I would have got to the same conclusion had I stayed in Sutton and not left. I think I had to leave to find that part of me in a way. So yeah, travel definitely gave me a lot. It's been really transformative, and it's helped me on my own personal journey, and it's helped me understand more of who I am.
And how do you feel now? I'm just, you know, like, and you know what, it's like, I would say it's really super hard, especially now that we're not able to travel as much. So I think it's an important part. Yeah, like Mame asked, you it's helped you and really discover your identity. So you've written the book now. How do you feel?
I feel good. I feel like, yeah, it's really strange sort of reflecting on the past years, because a lot happened to me in a short space of time. Like I was saying, I had a really nice upbringing in Sutton, apart from these kind of, you know, racialized encounters that would confuse me a lot as a child. But I had a really stable upbringing. My parents were always around, always helping out. They never argued. I didn't sort of overhear any conversations about, you know, is that my daughter or any of that stuff. It was not a thing. It just wasn't spoken about, and it was otherwise a very happy childhood. So then when my dad got sick, a lot happened in a short space of time, obviously getting DNA test results a year after him, and then deciding to leave everything I know and just travel. That was a very eventful few years, and now I'm in a process where I'm sort of reflecting and talking about things and connecting with other people through my writing, and it's really lovely. But it feels a bit surreal. I'm like, God, that did happen. Yeah, I did go through that. Yeah, I am okay now.
You know what? I've been teasing this with people, and they're like, oh, well, is this fiction book? I'm like, it's real, girl.
It's real life.
They're like, what? But I'm like, yeah. It's get raceless, and we need to talk about it after. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just, it is surreal. And even when I'm trying to write something else now, I want to start a fiction book, and I'm like, God, I couldn't make up half of it. That's a really weird thing to say, because obviously there's more interesting things that have happened than my own life, but it's a weird thing where I'm like, I don't know, just a lot of bizarre things happened to me, and it's brought me into contact with amazing people, and I've got, you know, this amazing book that I'm really proud of, but I guess it's sort of hard to write something else now in a different realm. Yeah. Mm. I'm still reflecting on my life, and I'm still sort of talking about race, so I'm just at the beginning of talking about this book, so there's going to be a lot more conversations to come, and I need to just get my head in the game basically and really explain it in a way that I hope people resonate with.
I think it opens up so many doors, like in so many conversations about just identity, blackness,
colorblindness,
like family, like our parents, like how we communicate with them or don't,
and
We could do like 3 or 4 other podcast episodes.
The research involved, but with your truth, and just bringing other comparisons in, it's just, I don't know whether the word is inclusive, but it had an element of inclusiveness touching all areas. So beautiful. Honestly, really beautiful.
Loved it. Well, guys, want to ask anything else? I can stay for a few more minutes. I know I said I have to leave at 30:30.
Let's keep it.
We're going to absolutely keep going. I just have like one final or two final questions, which is, when can people get the book? Where can they get it? And is it available on audio and all the things? Social?
Drum roll.
So we've just changed the date actually, so it's out February 18th in the UK and February 24th in the US.
And
you can get it on Amazon, you can get it on Waterstones, you can get it online, and then there's also the audio version, which I've actually recorded here in Lisbon, and I just that was really fun. I don't know how much about audio recording like books and stuff, but it's really draining. Like, it was super.
I've heard it's very draining. Yeah,
is it draining? Because I love listening.
Yeah, but to listen to, but it, right?
I actually pre-ordered the audio book because I want to actually hear your voice and your expression when reading. So I'm going to listen again because I think it'll be super beautiful to hear.
Thank you. Loads of people ask me like, are you doing the recording yourself? And I'd only ever thought about doing it myself. I couldn't imagine handing my story over to how can you bring it to life in the same way if I've lived it? Like,
it's literally your life.
So I've done that here in Lisbon. So if people want to hear the sadness and the saltiness in my voice, you can hear it all on the audio version, which you can download on Audible, I guess. And then the podcast as well on Audible, which is called Secrets in Us. That's also available.
Secrets in Us, amazing.
Secrets in Us. We will put a link to that in this episode. Where can people follow you on social media if you would like them to follow you?
You search me. It's Georgina Lawton _ on Instagram, because there's another Georgina Lawton that looks nothing like me. So don't look for that. And then Georgina Lawton on Twitter. And that's all my information. I think I need to make a website soon.
And we started the book with an extract on hair. What's your hair like now, girl? Let's give everyone a flavor.
I just got it braided in Lisbon like yesterday, because we're going into a national lockdown here, so that's really upsetting me. But I got a quick sort of head of box braids, but like quite thick and quite it wasn't time consuming. She was done in like 2.5 hours. So very speedy. So I found a little, the pocket of blackness in Lisbon.
Always find Send the details, please.
Literally, I can recommend salons for people going to Lisbon, because she's good. She's really good.
We've seen it. It looked really good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Georgina. This was so much fun. We wanted to grill you with more questions, but we ran out of time. So
you've given us so much of your time. Thank you so much.
And thank you for inviting me on. It's been amazing.
No problem at all. So that was us chatting to Georgina Lawton. It was so much fun. I had fun.
Much fun.
Yeah. She's very traveled, and also just like, what I really liked, one, about her book, but also just in general, is how she, I feel like she's found a way to, like, wherever she goes, she will find like the black community.
Yes. So I was like, you found a hairdresser? Now. She's like, yes, I know where to spot. I love how that's your take. You're like, she will find the community.
She'll find
it. That is important.
Especially black women, as we've talked about many times before this show, traveling abroad, finding your, whether it's finding your people or people you connect with that may or may not be black people, but also finding the space where you feel the safest when you are traveling is really important. So,
and where you can have a sense of belonging. And it is important. And you can still be you, be your whole self and bring it to the table. So no, I think it was like, I felt like, I was like, oh, Georgina girl, we'll have you back. Like, this is a lot of fun. I'm like, I had a lot of fun. 100%. Can't wait to, by force, impose a hangout.
No, it was honestly, and her book, like, not even just saying it, like when we got the book and we kind of, you know, got advanced copies, obviously, because it's not yet out.
But
it will be available for pre-order. But once we got that, I think we both just kind of sped through it and we just was like, there's so much in this.
Yeah.
That we can talk about.
I remember you being like, Mame, being like, have you read the book, Sam? And I'm like, not yet. I'm going to. That you're like, you need to read it. It's just, wow. So many revelations, so many things. And when I started, I was like, and there are many. I wish we could talk more. There's so many elements where you're just like, oh god,
and without spoiling too much.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but there are. It's very multi layered, and for a kind of nonfiction book, you know, it's her life, so it's a true story. It's kind of, it's very well written. You know, it's hard to write your own story
100%.
In a way where other people can connect. So that's also a real skill. So I really appreciate it and that. And chatting with her was just fun. She's just, she was cool.
Good. Yeah. Get the book, people. Raceless.
Buy the book.
Raceless. Buy the book in search of family identity and the truth about where I belong. Get the book. No.
It's out like 18th of Feb. You can pre-order it now everywhere, I think, pretty much. And it's going to be available on the Audible. Yeah, everything. So, you can get it. What we will, we'll be talking about it a little bit more in the one thing at the end of the episode. We are going to take a break right now and we'll be back with
I need a sip of water. Sweet tea. We'll be back.
Bye.
Welcome back to Head, Scarves and Carry-Ons. It's now time for Gist of the Week.
Wow, it's been a while.
So what are we gisting about? We gisting this week on, we all have the desire still to travel and are still at home 1 year later. I'm not saying up this gist well, but basically on today's Gist of the Week, we wanted to discuss books that, you know, myself and Mame, what are some books that have given you a travel fix, or programs or TV shows? What are you doing now to really, you know, infuse the wanderlust back into your life? Oh, I feel like a poet.
Ooh. Lovely. Well, books, I would have to say, not to be biased, but Raceless was definitely like one of the few books I read.
Ding, ding.
The last year that was very much like travel. I felt like I was really being taken to other places. And it was nice. I was like, oh, this is like, I felt like I was just, you know, stepping outside of current at home situation. But TV programs, like legit since the pandemic, pretty much since it started, I have been watching Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown on Netflix. For those of you that, if you don't know who he is, like, you're missing out. Or who he was, should I say, I'm sorry. He passed away in 2018, but he's like a chef, he's like a writer, he's like a travel chef guy, like culinary
genius. Just
brilliant. And he was just so, like, if you watch this show, he goes all over the world to, and he discovers countries that we know quite well, but actually all the parts of it you don't know at all. Hence the name Parts Unknown. but it was, you know, it's produced by CNN and everything. So it's very like, they have access to lots of places that maybe other shows might not be able to get to. But it's just like, oh, just the way that they show countries, and it's very personable. And it just felt like this was as close as we got to traveling and taking a holiday.
Okay, nice.
Watching that show. And I was like, definitely getting my life. Still watching it because there's loads of seasons. That's for me. Yeah, that's what I've been. Okay. That's honestly what I've been getting it.
I did not get that in my algorithm, so I'm going to try and look.
You got to look for it. You got to look.
I need
for
to
it.
Look. Yeah, seriously. I need to look hard. So
you won't regret it.
Yeah, that sounds like a good one.
What about you?
And food. Books wise, honestly, I agree with you. Especially this year, it is Raceless. That is the one book where I have really been able to deep dive into travel a lot more, because Georgina goes to so many different places and parts of the world and really explores different things there. And I think, as you said, it gave me the kind of like, desire again from a book perspective. I've read other things, but yeah, definitely this Raceless gave a good infusion into it. And then in terms of TV shows or programs, so hear me out.
Okay.
This is very weird, but this has been like, I've watched all the, you know, the hypey shows like Bridgerton, Mama, Papa, you know, One Lady Must. I've watched the Bridgerton, you know, I had to do it. I love speaking like, you know, in the olden times now. This is my new thing. I watched Lupin, which was amazing. But
I haven't watched that yet, but
I want to. Oh, Omar Sy.
Yeah.
Oh, another episode. But
anyway.
So I've been watching all of, you know, The Buzz, Queen's Gambit, all of that. But this was one show that actually made me think about the world again and travel. And it's called Inside World's Toughest Prisons. So yes.
Get your travel fix now, guys.
Honestly, but hear me out. So Raphael Rowe, he is the presenter of the show, and he's like a journalist, and he was accused, wrongfully accused of murder and convicted, and he was in prison for 12 years, wrongfully accused, quite a few years ago. And now on this show, which is also on Netflix, he goes to the world's toughest prisons around the world. And I was just like, okay, it was during the day. I was like, all right, let me watch it. And, you know, I kind of like a lot of those crime drug shows. I don't want it to be too realistic, but I like sometimes it's a good eye opener. And so the first prison he went to was one in South Africa, where there's a gang called like the Numbers Gang, and they even have their own language, Sibile, which has been created. And the Numbers Gang kind of, they run prison. Like even the officers, they don't run things. The officers know it's... You know, you have to be a number, or you're I had another word if you're not. But honestly, on the lead up to him going to the prison, I was like, South Africa is so beautiful. Like the shots, I was like, wow. This country was giving me chills, you know. And they were he was going to different parts in South Africa, so maybe like a bit more of the shanty places or the slums. And then he was going to the amazing places. So it was a real insight. And South Africa was on my 2020 travel list. Yeah. It is on my travel list. And because I haven't yet been, and I'm dying to. So it was like the vastness of it all. And, you know, just the disparity, it made me sad, but I was also like, wow, there's one prison, but in the medium side of it, you can sometimes do like more labor work where you're, you know, picking carrots in the farm, and the prisoners get to go out to like the farm. And I was like, wow, this is so nice. Like, honestly, I know it's bad, but I was like, damn. And he was even like, well, this is the only, like, if you're able to do this and you get like sectioned to this side of the prison, you're at least allowed more light and air, because in the maximum security one, they were hardly allowed even out of their cells. So I was like, wow. And then in another episode, he goes to the Philippines, and I was like, oh, another one on my travel list. And I was like, and obviously it's not all great, right? So because there's drug raids and there's prison scenes, but in those other glimpses, I was like, I really want to go to South Africa, obviously, and I really want to go to the Philippines. I know there's a massive war on drugs, and I do take it really seriously, but those scenery shots they were doing, I was like, I really want to visit. So,
well, you know, if anything tells you how desperate we are for a travel fix, I think that might be one example.
Yeah, it's a good show, but it's those few seconds, it's what got me back into travel. I was like, I'm missing
whatever
it.
Whatever works. Okay. Well, on that note, we will be right back with one thing. That's it for Gist of the Week.
Yes.
Hey everyone, welcome back. And it's now time for one thing to close out the show. This is where we kind of talk about one thing that was a takeaway from what we've talked about today. In this case, it is Georgina's book, Raceless. So we're going to talk about one takeaway from the book that remained with us. Mm-hmm. So what was your takeaway from Raceless, from reading it?
So my overall takeaway was, and because there was in this book, there's secrets and lies, and Georgina is chasing, obviously, the search for her identity and the truth. Mm. And especially after speaking with Georgina, I think the one thing I took away and I tried to understand was her mum. And I love the compassion and the forgiveness that Georgina has. And also from what she spoke about, from speaking with her, the healing that took place and how they've both been able to move forward. And that was the one thing that really resonated with me and I was able to take away, because, you know, reading the book and you do feel like, wow, but why and this and that? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, but then I'm just like, okay, when I was reading it and thinking through, I was like, you know what? There could have been reasons. I don't know what it was, but there could have, you know, and you just don't always know. But I love that, you know, and she always says it, like she loved her dad. Yeah. And she loves her mom and her family, and, you know, it's brought them stronger together. And I took that away, because being able to move forward and still explore who you are. And yes, this was a challenge and something that happened, but she can still move ahead and know who she is and explore her blackness. I really took that away. And I was just like, no, I'm really happy for her in that sense and her family. Like, Mama, you had also mentioned.
Yeah, what I said to you before we talked about it was, I think a part of that is also her, in this case, her mum, because her father obviously passed away, her mum's willingness to also help her find answers.
Yes,
her mum's willingness to at least try to engage. I think that's a big part of what helped her to actually move forward beyond the secret, like beyond all the possibly negative, you know, anger that sat behind it, was actually her mum's willingness to cooperate also.
Yeah,
I think that's a part of it. Like, I think, like I said, like forgiveness is, you can forgive someone, but obviously sometimes it's harder if you don't feel like that person is sorry.
Yeah.
You know? And actually maybe that could be holding you back from moving forward. Mm-hmm. And I feel like definitely the way that Georgina wrote about it and what she talked about with us, it sounds like, as you said in the interview, her and her mum were in therapy for 2 years. Like,
yeah, the commitment. That commitment. No, but it's important, exactly. Right?
That's how important it, but that's what I mean. That's a real show of commitment from her mother. And I think that sounds like it made a really, really big difference. So I think that's important part of the takeaway of what you're talking about.
Thank you. No, but yeah, thank you. Yeah. What did you take away? What was your one thing,
Mommy? My one thing was a particular element in the book that Georgina talked about called farming.
Yeah.
I don't know, for people that have never heard of this, essentially is a thing that began in the, late 50s, when Ghana and Nigeria gained independence from Britain. What was happening was then a lot of Ghanaian and Nigerian educated young people were being invited over to kind of join the workforce and, you know, blah, 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 as a friend of the empire, quote unquote, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And many of them came over with their children or had children when they came over. And then basically there was a network of some kind where they would send their children when they were often babies to live with a white British family.
It was white British
in the home counties, you know, in the country. And then what that meant was then kids were growing up as, so Georgina talks about as transracial, which is to say that the meaning of that actually is a child, usually a black or brown child, growing up in a white family, growing up in a family with a different race to them, basically. That's what it means. Well, it could happen the other way around, but it doesn't really
matter.
And it was called farming because it was like they were being sent to live out in these with these families while their, you know, biological parents were, you know, making money or getting education, whatever. And then at some point they would, for a lot of people, their then biological, often mother, comes back and just takes their child back home to wherever they live. And you just kind of pulled out of what you know to be home into this new environment where you don't have, you haven't had an intro to actually your cultural heritage at all, mm-hmm. like for a lot of people, you know, and you can feel very out of place. And it's a whole thing about kind of cracks your identity and stuff.
Yeah.
And to be honest, that and it hit me personally, but she explores it in such a way. It's very good. Like she mentions it as a way of just talking about these different ways that a lot of us, especially as Black Brits, have grown up with these fractured identities, whether it is by being in a transracial family, by being farmed out, or, you know, in an adoptive family, or you're a mixed race person, actually, mm-hmm. and you're the only mixed race person in your family. That kind of stuff is like how much it impacts. And I think, yeah, she really just highlighted a lot, just so much about family and about culture, cultural expectations, about identity, about nature versus nurture. Like for me, that was like a big, it kind of just explosion of new information.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of new ways of looking at kind of upbringing for me. So it was kind of like, it was very significant. Yeah. It took a lot away from.
And farming's an interesting one because I was saying to you, Mummy, obviously I was like, I knew about the farming, but I didn't know it had a word because, yeah, you grow up, growing up, I knew about it. You know of people, but I thought it was like a fostering system, but obviously it's not, it's not exactly the same. And it worked out different for different families because I know some people, they might have had visits every weekend from their parents or every other weekend. Sometimes it wasn't the case, but you know, you described it and go into detail perfect. And yeah, I agree. She really does talk about and explores, not to say this was exactly the same thing, but there are different experiences which then end up in the same sort of feelings and thinking and processes. So
Yeah, it's very eye-opening and from a personal perspective as a book.
Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah.
We recommend it. Coming out 18th of Feb.
18th of Feb.
Pre-order it now. Pre-order the audiobook and Jordina reads it herself, as you said, so you can look forward to that.
You can feel that,
ebook as well, everything. It's all everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, get on that and follow her on all the social medias and what have you.
Okay. So with that, I guess all we can say is thank you. Thank you for joining us back in 2021 and thank you for listening to this week's episode of Headscarves and Carry-Ons, all about Raceless by Jordina Lawton. And please, please, please don't forget to subscribe. Leave us a review if you would like to follow us at Mummy Blue Writes and at Abby_AK and use the hashtag Headscarf and Carry On to let us know what you thought about the episode. Yeah.
I guess. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye, Mummy.
Bye, Abby.